change how communities work together. So he has spent his career working to improve civic engagement and strengthening community nationally and internationally. So we are thrilled, and when I say thrilled, I do mean thrilled, today to have this talk about what's possible when we all work together to build and improve community. So I have no doubt that you're going to find this presentation so practical and inspirational. So please help me welcome Rich Garland.
Good morning, Kansas. How is everyone? I'm sorry I can't join you in person, but it's great to be with you via technology. And I know this is the last session for your conference, so congratulations on a fantastic conference and a successful conference. And I'm just hoping to talk for a few minutes this morning about where we are as a country, what it means for us to move forward, and how we can do that together. You know, it's funny, I've just spent 3.5 weeks in Australia crisscrossing that country and never having a problem with a flight. And here I am trying to get to the heartland of America from Washington, D.C., and my flight gets canceled. But, you know, wherever I went in Australia, I started each presentation by apologizing to our fellow friends in Australia about our politics here in America. And, you know, regardless of who each of us voted for in the last election, I think we probably all can agree now that our politics do not reflect the best of us. They don't reflect our values. They don't reflect who we seek to become. They certainly don't reflect our yearning to make a more perfect union. And I know that many of us in our country right now and in Kansas are nervous about where we are as a country and how we can move forward. And so, you know, after the election, I got a lot of phone calls from my friends all across America saying, you know, Rich, what are we going to do now? We're so divided, we're so polarized, and how is it that we're going to get to bridge the gaps between and among us in our country? And inevitably that conversation then turned to, you know, how is it that we're going to understand the anger that so many people in our country seem to feel nowadays? And that then turned into a conversation about, you know, how is it that I'm going to be able to demonstrate that I, you know, feel the pain of everyone in our country? And inevitably that conversation evolved into, and by the way, Rich, how am I going to get everyone to agree with me on my position about what I think we need to do in this country, right? And it seems to me that if that's the position we're going to take, my God, we're not going to be able to move forward in our communities, in Kansas, in the United States of America. You know, our media and our politicians tell us that we're polarized, but I've come to believe that there's something much deeper, something more profound, something more important that we need to be thinking about right now. And it's not so much that we're polarized. I think it's that we have a set of grievances in our country and that there are any number of us in different groups that have grievances. It's almost as if we've retreated into our enclaves, into a set of tribes, if you will, where we each have a set of grievances about what's wrong from our perspective, that so many of us feel that we've been left out and left behind, that so many of us don't feel as though we have a real shot at the American dream. And I'm not just talking about people on the fringes. I'm talking about even middle-class folks in Kansas who now have grievances about the fact about how is it that I'm going to send my child to college or to community college and make a real go of things? How is it that we're going to still pursue the American dream in my family and in my community? And so the question is, and in these grievances that we have, my fear is, you know, if we're polarized, it might mean that we're talking with each other and we're arguing with one another. But in our grievances, I fear that we're not even talking to one another. We're talking past one another. We're not even hearing one another. We're not even seeing one another. And so I think we need a different approach if, in fact, we want to make community a common enterprise, which is what I believe we need to do in America right now. We need to make community a common enterprise where we're all pulling in a similar common direction with a sense of shared purpose. Now, when I say that, I have to say that I come to this conversation this morning with some fears, fears about our own sector, about the nonprofit sector, about the funding sector, about the faith sector, about our response to what we see happening in the country. And my fear goes something like this. I, I fear that we will double down on some of the common responses that we have when we see things aren't working in our communities. So let me just give you three things that I fear we'll double down on. One is that we'll double down on mechanical responses, that we'll believe that if we simply have more data and we figure out more data about what's going wrong in our communities, that if we turn more to things like collective impact initiatives that are imposed upon communities, that somehow or another we'll fix the problems that are in our communities. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm a huge believer in data. I know that the Kansas Health Foundation is a big proponent of data. You look at a lot of indicators. I think that's really important. I believe in the importance of data, of evidence-based decision-making, of best practices. But this is what I also know, that data can't tell us about people's lived experiences, that data can't tell us about the struggling mom with two children and what's keeping her awake at night, worried about her kids going to school, to an inadequate public school or an inadequately funded public school the next day. That data can tell us about our healthcare issues, but it can't tell us about the struggles people experience in their lives trying to ensure their well-being and to make sure that they have enough food on their tables to feed their children at night. That data can't tell us about the emotional trauma that some families are feeling in our communities now, about the mental health issues that they're confronting. And so as important as data is, I believe we need a certain knowledge from our communities that only our communities can provide themselves, which I'll come back and talk to about in a few minutes. But data alone, or these notions of collective impact, we're going to align everyone moving in a common direction, and we're going to align all our funding and all our programs. That alignment is important, but not if we don't have a deep understanding of people's lived experiences, not if we don't ensure that our communities are actually have the capacity and the readiness to take on those types of sophisticated, complex initiatives. We need to start where communities are, not where we wish they were to be. And it seems to me that if we double down on some of these professional responses around data and collective impact and other types of efforts, that we will miss what people are wrestling with in their communities and in their lives. So that's number one. Number two, I believe that we'll double down in the belief that if we simply talk more to one another, that if we simply have more conversations and hold more forums, that somehow we'll be able to get past and get through our grievances and somehow end the polarization that marks our communities and that is holding us back and often holding us hostage. But this is what I know, simply coming together for more conversations isn't going to do the trick. Simply believing that if we sit in a circle and somehow hold hands and sing Kumbaya, that somehow that's going to resolve the real and heartfelt grievances and challenges that we feel in our communities. We need to do more than simply talk, and I'll come back to that as well. Simply talking will provide a sense of false hope that somehow it will lead to action, but if our talk isn't connected to real action, people will once again believe we'll all talk and more and not enough action. And that will diminish our sense of faith. It will diminish our sense of hope. It will diminish our sense of possibility that we can actually move forward together. And then let me mention a third area where I fear our sector will double down, and I see it happening every day. And that is that we'll turn to advocacy. Now, I believe in advocacy. I'm sure you've heard speakers talk at this conference over the last couple of days about being better advocates. I suspect maybe you have. Our nation was founded on pluralism. It was founded on the notion of advocating. My God, we advocated against King George to declare our independence and to fight the American Revolution. So I'm a big believer in advocacy. But there's something else happening in modern day America that's different than what was happening when our founding fathers founded this great nation of ours. We are in an arms race now around advocacy. We're using the polarization and the grievances that we find in our country, and we're leveraging them to raise more money so that each of our advocacy positions have more money. It's like an arms race where we can raise our voices louder, where we can shout louder, where we can push people into corners harder and with greater force. And here's what I ask you. When you fear what's happening in your own personal life, and someone begins to raise their voice even louder, and they tell you that you need to change even more, what is it that you do? Is it that you come out, or is it that you hold your hands over your ears and that you retreat out of fear for giving up whatever you have? We don't need to yell louder at one another. We don't need to raise more money to take up more arms against one another. We don't need to use advocacy as a weapon against one another. We need to find ways to come together and bridge our divides and figure out how we can move forward with a shared sense of purpose. My fear with advocacy is when we take up arms in our advocacy right now in 2017, we believe that we are right and everyone else is wrong. And in our belief that we are right, we then become righteous. And in our righteousness, we believe that there is no other room for anyone else but those who believe as we do. And I know you have faced this in Kansas. I know you are battling this in Kansas. And in our righteousness, we then close our eyes to one another. We close off our ears to one another. We close off our hearts to one another. And when that happens, we will inevitably close off the possibilities to make community a common enterprise again in our communities across the great state of Kansas, across the heartland of America, and across our entire United States of America. We need a different path if we want to make community a common enterprise in our country again and in our communities. So let me offer that alternate path, or at least some ideas about it this morning. And I hope you're still with me. I can't see you. I know you can only see me. And so I hope you're still with me as I'm speaking here. You know, if we want an alternate path, first and foremost, I don't believe it's about adopting new techniques, as important as those techniques are. I think it needs to start in something more fundamental, more basic, more radical, if I can say that word. And when I say radical, I mean more something at the root of the real cause of our challenges today. I believe first and foremost, we need to begin with our mindset about what direction that we're facing as we do our work together. You know, far too many of us, unbeknownst to ourselves, against our own yearnings, we've turned inward toward ourselves, away from one another. And it seems to me if we want to make community a common enterprise, if we want to bridge the divides that we face in our society, if we want to meet our yearning for a greater sense of possibility and hope in our lives, then we need to turn outward toward one another. We need to make our community our reference point, not our boardroom. We need to have community in our line of sight all the time. Now, I've been doing this work for 30 years. I've got a lot of gray hair to show it at this point. And I know that saying that we need to be turned outward, it's easier said than done. I know it's intuitive. I know it's obvious. But you know as well as I do that so many of us are turned inward. Our reference point is our own organization. It's not the community. We see the community as the playing field for our own programs, for our own metrics, for raising our own dollars to support our own mission, to get credit for things that we want to take credit for, sometimes that we did, sometimes that we didn't even do. We turn inward to pursue our own success, sometimes to protect our own survival. And I ask you, if we want to make community a common enterprise again in Kansas, can we afford to be turned inward toward ourselves and toward our own programs and toward our own organizations? Or I believe that we must turn outward toward one another to see each other and to make community a common enterprise. Now, when we do turn outward, there are certain things I think we need to do. Number one, I think we need to make each other visible. I think we need to see and hear one another again. As I said before, I think in our country, we are unfortunately dividing into tribes, into clans, where we're fighting one against one another, where our own self-interests are overruling our common interests, where our sense of our own grievances are outdoing what we know we hold in common. And so I believe we need to see and hear each other. And to do that, I believe we need to focus on our shared aspirations for moving forward. We need to have a different conversation as a starting point, not just talk, but a different conversation. It's not a utopian conversation about creating these visioning exercises for our communities. I don't know in Kansas if you do this, but I know in the other 49 states we do. I've been there. You know, those visioning exercises where you have those little yellow dots and you put them up on the wall and the facilitator says, you know, don't talk too much, Kansas. We don't have too much time. Just put the little yellow dot up on the issue that you care most about. Then we'll tally them up and we'll figure out where we want to go. And then we'll produce a report that's in four color on glossy paper and we'll print thousands of them, right? And we'll distribute them everywhere. And those glossy reports, they're going to have 1,300 recommendations and 300 task forces. And we announce them at a press conference and we're real happy about all of it. And then 5 months later, 6 months later, a year later, 2 years later, I ask you, what happens to those nice glossy four color reports that we printed? Where are they? Has any action emerged? And you and I both know oftentimes they end up at the bottom of the pile. They end up in a filing cabinet. They end up in the bottom of a trash can. And the reason why is simple. Because those visioning exercises are utopian visions and no one's interested in utopia. People are trying to create a better life for themselves. They want to ensure their kids go to good schools. They want to ensure they live in safe neighborhoods. They want to ensure they have adequate health care. They want to ensure there's adequate food on the table at night. They want to know their kids can go to higher education and succeed and pursue the American dream. And so we need to have conversations about our shared aspirations, about where we want to go together. And here's the thing about shared aspirations. If you try this today, before you leave this conference or when you go home tonight or at church on Sunday or wherever you may go, our aspirations always come from our gut. They're always things that matter to us in our lives. They're always things that are actionable, they're doable, and they're achievable. And here's the other thing about our shared aspirations. When we hear each other talk about them, we come to recognize that while we may not share everything in common, which, you know, we don't need our politicians and news media to keep reminding us of that. We know that. It's obvious we don't share everything in common. But when we focus on our shared aspirations, we can understand what we do share in common. And we can begin to peel those things off. And we can begin to work on them together. And we can begin to make a sense of progress. And we can begin to create a sense of possibility. And here's the other thing about shared aspirations. When we hear them articulated, when we articulate them together, we begin to recognize that no one single organization, no one single leader, no one single foundation will ever be able to achieve these shared aspirations alone. That we must work together. These shared aspirations implicate us in terms of our organizations, our faith-based groups, our funders, our citizens, we as citizens, that we must begin to work together to move forward. So number one, we must see and hear one another around our shared aspirations if we want to move forward in a positive, productive way. The second thing is, I think we must learn to build things together. As I said earlier, it's not enough to talk. It's not enough just to have conversations. I think we need to come together and build together. You know, there's something so powerful when we begin to do things together and recognize that each of us have talents and skills and resources and gifts that maybe we never recognized before. That each of us, no matter the color of our skin or where we live or our zip code or how much money we have in our wallet or what kind of car that we drive or what our faith or denomination might be, that we each have gifts and resources and talents that we can bring to the table and make something happen together. And so I think in our efforts to move our communities forward, we must find ways to bring people together to build things. Now, I have no illusions that as we build things that we'll solve all the systemic challenges that we face. But here's what I know from going across the country, that unless and until we bring ourselves together to rebuild our confidence that we can come out from our homes and set goals together. That when we set goals together that we can begin to move forward and act on those goals, even in small ways. That when we're acting on those goals, that inevitably we will fall down. And when we fall down, that we can demonstrate to ourselves and to one another that we have the wherewithal, the wisdom, the confidence, the ability to get up and scrape off our knee and to keep moving forward. That when we come out from our homes and set a goal together and start to move down a path and we fall down and stand back up and scrape off our knee, that when we finally achieve something as small as maybe just painting a school or cleaning up a park or making sure a kid can walk safely to school in the morning or come home in the afternoon at dark, that when we do that and we celebrate that small success, I know that's not going to fix the systemic issues in our community. But this is what I also know after doing this work for 30 years, that unless we rebuild our confidence and our capabilities and our belief in ourselves and in one another, we will never get to those larger systemic issues. We will never tackle the larger systemic issues of funding inequities in Kansas around education, which I know exist. We will never get to the healthcare issues that I know exist in Kansas. We will never get to the issues of hunger and poverty, which I know still exist in Kansas. And so we must rebuild our confidence that we can come together and deal with these challenges in our communities. And lastly, let me say that I think if we turn outward, we need to focus on a new notion of shared responsibility in our communities. And I've said this before, and I just want to underscore it. So many of the challenges that we face, you know, as hard as each of you work, and I know you work hard, as much money as I know you want to raise, and I know you work hard to raise that money, none of us alone are going to solve the problems that we face. They're too big. They're too systemic. And so it seems to me that we need to find ways to come together and solve problems. You know, I just came back on my way from Australia through Hawaii, where I'm working on education reform there with a number of groups. And Native Hawaiians in Hawaii, there's a huge achievement gap between Native Hawaiians and other folks, other kids in Hawaii. And you know what's closing the achievement gap for those Native Hawaiians? It's not making the schools even more responsible and placing even more demands on the schools. It's recognizing that there are educators throughout our communities who understand different cultures, who understand different ways that kids can learn, who can, for instance, by taking kids to the wetlands or to the ocean or to the land or to the mountains in Hawaii, for instance, can teach kids about environmental issues in ways that make algebra and science more relevant to their learning and turn those kids on to learning and turn those kids on to believing that they have value and worth and intrinsic value in themselves and turn on a belief that they can go on to community college or onto a four-year school and turn on a belief that they too can become doctors and lawyers and scientists and pharmacists and engineers and policemen and firemen. We have educators throughout Kansas, much like in Hawaii, who can make schools and education a community enterprise, not just a school enterprise. The opioid crisis in a community where we're working with in Kentucky now, in opioid crisis and heroin and meth are crises throughout our country. Here in Maryland, where I live, it's the number one crisis. In Virginia, just across the Potomac, it's the number one crisis. Now, I know in working in Kentucky that drug treatment, formal drug treatment, is really important to solving that problem. But here's what I also know, that no person who is addicted to opioids is going to be able to move off of drugs on their own. That they're going to need a network of family members, of community members, of faith-based groups, of groups like YMCAs and Boys and Girls Clubs and other organizations and groups. We're going to need to surround them with support and love from very different directions. That's going to take a shared responsibility in our communities to solve these problems. I know you heard from Diana Aviv, who was one of your kickoff speakers at the conference this week. She's a good friend of mine. I've known her for many years. I know now she's with Feeding America. I know the hunger crisis. I've worked in Bakersfield, California, and in other places where we have hunger issues. I know that organizations working on these issues are really important, but so too are the networks of different groups, schools, where we place the food, how we support one another, how we grow new grocery stores and other businesses in food deserts. This is going to be a shared responsibility if we're going to fight hunger and poverty in our communities together. You know, for years, we have defined our challenges as political challenges in our country. And 20 years ago, 30 years ago, in 1990, I wrote the first report in America that said Americans don't feel apathetic about politics, they feel pushed out. And when I wrote that report, 180,000 copies were distributed. I was on every news program there was in the country. And at that point, people felt as though our politicians had betrayed them and the news media and special interests had as well. But now, 30 years later, we still face some of the same challenges. But what I've come to understand is that our challenges are not political. They are a human challenge. They're about how we live our lives together in our communities. They're about how we decide to come together. They're about whether or not we are willing to see and hear one another as human beings. They're about whether or not we are willing to come out of our homes together and build together. They're about whether or not we are willing to take shared responsibility for our communities, notwithstanding or in spite of what our politicians do, and in spite of what the news media tells us, and in spite of what special interests try to do to divide us against one another. It is our country and our responsibility to come together and make things happen. And so before I close, people often ask me, why is it that I do this work? Why is it that last night as I was stuck at Dulles Airport trying to figure out how I could get from Washington, D.C. to Dallas-Fort Worth and then to fly to Wichita, and my staff was telling me, you know, well, you can get there if you take 16 flights on different routes and then walk the last 1,000 miles. I would have done it if I thought I could get there on time. But before I close, I just want to tell you a little bit about why I do this work, why I wanted to pipe in via technology this morning, why I'm so committed to what you're doing, why I believe so deeply in what you're doing. And as I tell you just a really small part of my own personal story, I hope you'll know I do it because I want you to know what motivates me. But I also want to tell you just a small part of my own personal story because I hope it reminds you of your own story, about why you do this work, about why you work so hard. You know, when I was born in the early 1960s, I was diagnosed with cystic fibrosis. In the early 1960s, that was a death sentence. I had 3 to 5 years to live. There was a point at which the doctors turned to my mom and said, face it, he's a lemon. No one expected me to make it this far, and no one ever expected me to have the honor to be talking with you here today all the way to Kansas. I grew up most of my childhood in hospital rooms. I have vivid memories of being in hospital beds with all the doctors and nurses and specialists all surrounding my hospital bed every morning, all talking about me, but never talking to me. I travel for a living, as you know, and each time I check into a hotel room, I take that little plastic card and I put it up to the door, and I open that door. Even to this day, I'm 56 years old now, even to this day when I open up that hotel room, it still reminds me not of a hotel room, but of a hospital room. It wasn't until maybe a decade ago that as I traveled and stayed in hotel rooms that I didn't sleep with every light turned on all night long and I didn't sleep in my clothes. But you know, I was lucky. I consider myself lucky. Much later in my life, my diagnosis ultimately changed. But before I knew that, I was saved by my community. I had an next-door neighbor named Jack Brundage who worked on the assembly line for General Mills cereals. He packaged Cheerios and other cereals that we all eat. And he had a wood shop in his backyard. And Mr. Brundage used to take me into his wood shop on weekends and teach me how to make things with my hands. He taught me that I could be a builder, that I could produce things. I had another neighbor, Jack Petker, who lived a few blocks away from me, who used to, on weekends, do errands, electricity errands, some in my place of faith. And when we would go there on weekends, and we'd find an electrical problem, and it would be up in the ceiling, and he'd put the ladder out. He would make me climb up that ladder, and I'd be scared. And I realized now, as he kept encouraging me to climb one rung after another, what he was encouraging me to do was to realize that I could reach for my potential, and I could keep climbing and not let fear overcome me. I had a coach named Ray Rivers who had seasonal jobs. You might say he came from the other side of the tracks, but he was my coach in basketball and baseball all through my youth, and he knew I was a sick child. And what he taught me was that I could exert myself physically, and that I could still win, and I could still work at things, and I could still have a sense of possibility and hope that my life could get better. I do this work like you because I believe that every individual in Kansas, no matter the color of their skin, no matter where they live, no matter how much money they have, no matter what kind of car their parents drive, that every individual should have dignity. I believe that each and every child in Kansas should wake up not believing, as I did, that tomorrow could be worse than today, but they have a sense of hope and possibility that today will be better than yesterday and tomorrow can be even better. I do this work like you do because I believe that every Kansan deserves a voice and a place at the table. I do this work because I still believe, notwithstanding the challenges in our country, I still believe that America is an exceptional country and that every individual in our country should have a fair shot at the American dream, and that American dream still counts for something. So as I said to you before, I tell you this story in part so you know what motivates me, but I also tell you this story in part because I hope it reminds you of the work, of why you do the work that you do. You know, I believe that each of us has an urge to do good within us. I believe it's innate. If I can say this, I believe it's God-given. I believe we're born with it. And I believe that we want to activate it and act on it each and every day. But you and I know in our common environment right now, in our common context, that urge to do good, sometimes it gets diminished. Sometimes people tell us, don't worry so much about your ideals, just get your job done. Don't worry about making a difference, just hit your metrics. Don't worry about that child down the street, just get your funding report in. Don't worry about all the things that you believe need to happen in society. Just keep your head down and hunker down and get your job done. This urge to do good, it gets diminished, it gets caked over, we're told not to worry about it. And if there's nothing else that you remember that I say today, I hope it's this. The urge to do good that you have, and now I'm just talking to each of you individually, not the person sitting next to you, not this person sitting behind you, not the person sitting in front of you, but just to you. The urge to do good that you have within you, it's the most precious gift you have. It's the thing that enables you to keep going. It's the thing that enables you when you have funding cuts to say that you can still do more. It's the thing that enables you when people tell you that change is not possible in Kansas. It's what enables you to say, oh no, yes, change is still possible and change still can happen. And if we come together and share responsibility, we can do more than we ever thought was possible before. Don't let anyone ever take your sense of urge to do good away from you. Don't let anyone ever tell you it's not important. Don't let anyone tell you that it needs to be diminished or you need to that the light should go out somehow. This urge to do good is the most precious gift each and every one of us has. We need to protect it. We need to make it shine. We need to make it visible to one another. We need to spread it to one another. So let me just close with this. I don't know if in the intro this was mentioned, but back in 2012, I'm sure you remember the Newtown, Connecticut tragedy that occurred, where a 19-year-old gunman named Adam Lanza walked into Sandy Hook Elementary School and murdered 20 first graders and killed 6 adults. Not 5 weeks after that tragedy, I got a call from the mayor of Newtown, Connecticut. And she asked me whether or not I'd be willing to come to Newtown and design and lead a process by which that community could move forward. At first, I was overwhelmed by the request, and I told her I needed to think about it. And then, frankly, after some prayer and after thinking about it, I called her back and said I'd be honored to try to help the community move forward. It was one of the most harrowing experiences I've ever had in my life, and one of the most difficult ones. Every meeting we held was in public, covered by CNN and the New York Times and the Washington Post, and no one believed that we'd ever make progress. But here's what I want to tell you about today. The first time that I went to Newtown, I flew up from Washington, D.C. to Hartford, Connecticut, and then rented a car and drove 45 minutes from the airport in Hartford to Newtown. When I drove to Newtown, I went to the town hall where the mayor's office was. And as I drove up to the town hall, I parked my car and walked in. It was a small building. Newtown's a town of about 27,000 people. The town hall is a one-story building and has lots of different offices in it, including the mayor's office. As I walked into the town hall, I looked to the right and I saw the mayor's office. And I saw the door to the city council chambers where we would hold all of our public meetings that CNN and all those other groups would cover about what decision we would make about what to do with the Sandy Hook Elementary School and how that community might move forward. But before I turned to my right and walked to the mayor's office, I don't know what happened, but something came over me. And I turned to my left and I saw on an interior glass wall two signs. The first sign was a green sign with a white border, which I now have hanging in my office. And that sign said, "We are Sandy Hook, we choose love." The second sign was a white sign with a green border, which I also have hanging in my office today. And it read, "Our collective strength and resilience will be an example to the rest of the world." Our collective strength and resilience will be an example to the rest of the world. Now, I've stayed in touch with the mayor and other people in Newtown, and they've had many setbacks since 2012, but I can witness to the fact that they have been an example to the rest of the world in their courage and humility in taking one step after another to move forward and put their lives back together. But here's what I want you to remember about Kansas. My hope is in Kansas, in every community across Kansas, that sign, our collective strength and resilience, will be an example to the rest of the world, that sign will hang in your community, that sign will hang in your nonprofit, that sign will hang in your laundromats, that sign will hang in your cafes, that sign, our collective strength and resilience, will be an example, maybe not to the rest of the world, but it will be an example to our community, that we can come together and turn outward, that we can come together and see and hear one another, that when we turn outward, we can come together and build together, and when we turn outward, we can turn together and create shared responsibility to ensure that our community is a common enterprise again. I'm here today to tell you, Kansas, we need you. We need your hard work to demonstrate to yourselves and to the rest of the country that we don't need to live in a polarized nation. We don't need to live with our grievances. We don't need to hear politicians keep telling us we're divided. We don't need to hear the sensationalism and hype from our news media. We don't need to hear all the special interests and advocates tell us why we're so divided from one another, but that we have the capability and can-do spirit still in America to come together and get things done and demonstrate that the American dream still exists. Thanks so much for having me.